My name is Tim Hurt, and I'm currently a third-year PhD student in the Higher Education and Organizational Change Program at the University of California in Los Angeles, also known as UCLA. Outside of my capacity as a full-time doctoral student, I also engage in creative consulting, where I work with different nonprofits in the areas of governance, culture, and student success. And outside of my capacity as a consultant, I also have engaged in community organizing, and that's been reflected within my work developing a mentorship organization for young Black men at one of my alma maters, Michigan State University, that served as a pipeline of support for young Black men from Michigan State to the greater Lansing community. And I most recently developed the Black Alumni Association for my city back home, where I currently serve as president and CEO. And our mission is to engage with alum and also current students through mentorship, while also holding their school board accountable and creating collaborative opportunities to continue to advocate on behalf of the best interests of the students. I'm very excited to be joining you all for conversation.
Good morning, good evening, depending upon what part of the world you're in. If it's Friday, you know it is the CEO series. And you just heard from Tim Hurt, a PhD student, who's going to be our guest today. Amazing background, third year PhD student, higher education and organizational change at UCLA. Does a lot of work, a lot of community work, and we're going to get into all of that. So, Tim, we always like to start the program when we're interviewing people to talk about how did Tim become Tim?
Absolutely.
Give us a journey of that.
Sounds good. Well, first, thank you again for having me on. I appreciate it. And Tim, for me, became Tim in Detroit, Michigan, area code 313. So that's where I'm from. It started with my parents really instilling work ethic of hard work and also just, you know, love, showing people love and just leading with actions and not just talking about it, but also walking the walk. So it started in Detroit, started with my parents, and it led to where I'm currently at right now.
Okay. Wow. So you undergrad was Michigan, was it?
Michigan State. I went to Michigan State for undergrad, where I received my bachelor's in elementary education.
Okay. So where did the passion for the PhD and org change and higher ed come from? Was that kind of the goal, or you just kind of something happened?
Yeah. Absolutely. That's a great question. So the passion for pursuing a PhD actually started the summer before my freshman year of undergrad over at Michigan State University. I did a summer bridge program called the Urban Educators Cohort Program, UECP. And it was the first time that I had really been surrounded around Black folks who had their PhDs. And for me, that was really inspiring. It made me feel like I could go out and accomplish that myself.
Wow. And that drove that. So you went from there and now you're there. So you said third year. When do you get the, what do you call it?
The regalia, doctoral regalia and everything. I get that. Well, the goal is to walk the stage June 2025. So I'm actually currently working on my dissertation right now. I just finished up chapter one. I'm probably doing a traditional 5-chapter dissertation. So I have 4 more chapters and just kind of building that work out right now.
Mm-hmm. What is the title? Would you want to share that or?
Absolutely. So it's still a work in progress, a working title, but it's the end of affirmative action, analyzing UC Regents' response to Proposition 209, which repealed affirmative action in employment and admissions in the state of California.
Yeah. That's a whole nother discussion. We'll leave that for another time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's great that you're doing that. So how do you begin research for a dissertation? Undergrad, you know what that is. You know, you take the exams, you do what you got to do, but not so much defending your accomplishments.
Right.
What does that look like for a PhD vantage point?
Absolutely. So I'm in the thick of it right now. So I could kind of give you some firsthand experience, but the steps or to the PhD really starts with just kind of figuring out what you're interested in. So prior to even beginning your doctoral program, they have like a statement of purpose. Some institutions have a purpose statement, And you kind of talk about the research that you want to explore, why you feel like you would be able to contribute to the field in XYZ ways. And also within that, there's a literature review. So that's a really big part of the research. And that's, in fact, my second chapter of my dissertation. And that's just all the information that's currently out there. And your whole purpose is to figure out how you're going to contribute to the field and add something new or extend the literature that and scholarship that's already out there.
Okay, add something new. So five chapters. Do you reference, do you go back and look at, to see what's written on that on a topic before you choose a topic?
Yes.
Because it could be overloaded or what? How do you approach that?
Absolutely. So for the literature review, you go and you review a lot of the information that's already written on your topic, if not all the information. So that's where a lot of the time is spent for most people's at least early on with their dissertation. It's just really collecting all the data that's out there and disseminated in a way to kind of provide like a short summary. Well, relatively speaking, a short summary about 40 to 45 pages of what that looks like. And sharing that information and then building off of like, well, this is my research and this is what I plan to do. And then kind of, explaining that within your results and your future findings.
Wow. So after, do you see possibly a book coming out of this? Because I mentioned to you earlier, we don't really want to go there because that could take that's a whole nother discussion.
Right.
Do you possibly see a book or possibly some legislation coming out of it since you do a lot of community work?
Absolutely. My whole point of me pursuing a PhD is to be able to pay it forward to my community in actionable ways. So I definitely see this work really being able to pay it forward and hopefully influence legislation, especially with the topic that I'm covering around Proposition 209, with that being such a timely piece with the recent Supreme Court's ruling in late June.
Okay. Well, how did you choose that topic? I mean, because you higher education, organizational change, PhD, how did you kind of zero in on that as an area of focus?
For me, I was always interested, starting during my undergraduate years at Michigan State University, I had the opportunity to begin to work with our university administration. And that's kind of where this fascination of university governance and a particular board of trustees was kind of curated or sparked. Because the last second half or the last semester that I had in undergrad, I served unofficially because I only had one semester left as our student trustee at Michigan State University. And it was through that experience that I began to work even more closely with administration. And that was based off of the development of my own mentorship organization. So it was really this connection between governance and student success.
So if you had to give a primer on challenges, because I know, not that I know, because I've never gone beyond, the formal education. I've never gone that route. How do you handle the challenges of approaching a PhD program from an undergrad perspective? Because I know sometimes you get up and you're like, oh, geez.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, a PhD can be, it can be overwhelming sometimes. So I think approaching it from an undergraduate perspective, for me, I can speak specifically for me as an undergrad. So I reached out to a lot of folks who were in their doctoral programs during my undergraduate studies. And it was something for me. So being in the social sciences, it's more encouraged to go out and get practical experience after finishing your undergraduate degree. So social sciences being more so like education focused or sociology. So for me, it was encouraged to go out and pursue a master's degree, which I ended up doing. And completing my master's degree in higher education at the University of Pennsylvania before beginning my PhD here at UCLA. But during my time in undergrad, I worked a lot with different research programs, the Summer Research Opportunity Program within the Big Ten Alliance. And also, just sitting at the feet of doctoral students and asking them, yo, how's this experience? How's your journey? Bugging them sometimes, but other people were really excited to just kind of share and just see a young person just so enthusiastic about this idea of research and the significance that it could potentially have on people.
That's amazing. I've always been a big fan of you. I told you this earlier, a big fan of yours. I've always followed you. That's why I reached out. And what really intrigued me about you at your age to be so focused, not that I want to put people in the box, but a lot of people your age is not as laser focused as you are, even based on what you've said so far. Mm-hmm. Where did that come from? I mean, that focus that you could just zero in on something and say, this is the direction I want to go. Challenges, I'll deal with the challenges, but I want to keep moving.
Absolutely. You're far too kind. I think for me, coming from a family that's very service oriented, I grew up and just very early, just seeing my mother and seeing my father in particular, just working with community and engaging that work. And there's a level of focus that they had and they brought even to this day, just in their day to day interactions. And I had the gold standard or a model from the time I was born up until now. So having parents who were very much so focused on the work that they did, having a mission, wow, but continuing to just serve others, just really inspired mm-hmm. me and inspires me in all the work that I do now. So, I mean, yeah. I really had it easy. I was really blessed in that regard.
Yeah. So when you're in front of these young people, and we'll get to your organization that you started, mm-hmm. do you feel like you're duplicating? You know, you hear yourself sometimes and say, wow, I sound just like my father.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny because, and I know we'll talk about it a little bit, but when I started my mentorship organization, really all the information that I kind of soaked up from my father over the years kind of regurgitated that. So that was all yeah. coming out of me. And I was like, man, I really sound like my father. But, you know, as a child, you're like, oh, I hear you, like, that's cool or whatever. But I kind of want to do my own thing. But I kind of found myself very quickly, like 20 years old, just kind of going back and being like, hey, these mm-hmm. are the principles that got me to this place. And these are yeah. the principles that I want to continue to spread out to other people because they're good values at the end of the day. It's a value system. So,
Okay. So tell me about the organization that you founded and how all that came about. Now, I know we've been leading into those, you know, in this direction.
Yes.
But to sit and say, you know what, I'm going to start this foundation and I'm going to start doing this work, and give us some background on that one.
Absolutely. So the mentorship organization that I started was Rising Black Men. And it's a pipeline of support for Black men from Michigan State to the greater Lansing community. And I started that program September 17th, 2017. So it was my junior year. And it was influenced off of the research that I did through the Summer Research Opportunity Program. And also my freshman year, I lived in a quad. So there were four of us. And the other three folks within the quad were Black men as well. And two of them, or all three of them, happened to be my best friends, especially transitioning to Michigan State, 50,000 people on campus. It's a huge institution. So for me, like, those guys were like, we had a nice just camaraderie about ourselves. And after our first year, two left because of academic reasons. And then one left in terms of just the social reason, of terms of not feeling a sense of belonging. So for me, that was my catalyst to begin engaging in research. And I saw a lot of literature that had a lot of deficit oriented language towards Black men in terms of low retention, persistence, and completion rates. So that mm-hmm. kind of excelled or kind of encouraged me to begin doing the research.
Wow. You know, when you go, you mentioned that, because when I go back, and this is years back in college, you know, you start at freshman year, everybody's there. But as the years keep going on, you see that number diminished. And I went to you know, HBCU, and so you know what I mean as it relates to that. But my daughter graduated Penn State, and she was one of the few that was there. And she had struggles, you know, dealing with that, you know, surrounded and not feeling a sense of belonging. But she stuck it out in the 4 years, and she graduated. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, congratulations to your daughter, because that persistence piece is very important. And it's something that a lot of universities even now continue to try to find different strategies about finding, you know, different student success initiatives and summer bridge programs, like the bridge program I did, to kind of create these cohorts before you even arrive to campus to kind of, you know, get you more comfortable in that sense of belonging and that connection.
Okay. Long-term impact of what would you, if you could look into the future 4 to 5 years from now and think about the program you're now creating, what would it look like? What would that future look like?
Absolutely. So the goal would be to continue to just build out the program within different Big Ten institutions. Every institution has a different demographic in terms of the amount of Black students, and in particular the amount of Black men on their campuses. But it would be great to continue to just expand in that regard. So basically have different chapters within the Big Ten. in particular. And that was an initiative that I had been working on a few years prior. I haven't been over the organization within the last 3, maybe 4 years, but they're still running 6 years later, and they're still continuing to pay it forward. So I would say establishing some chapters within the Big Ten, and also continuing to just do the mission that it's doing now, which is serving the young Black men at Michigan State and going into different school districts, and in particular within Lansing, which is the local school district in East Lansing, and working with the young Black men through different programming and mentorship as well.
So would that translate to other universities? I mean, what would a session look like if there was a weekly session? Would that be coaching, mentoring, or are you bringing people from outside? Or
yeah, absolutely. So for the, I guess, breakdown of it, we have learning objectives. And learning objectives are our opportunities where we bring folks from inside the community who we can, you know, see ourselves within, who are doing exciting work, who might be doctors, who might be lawyers, who might be engineers, who might be CEOs of their own companies. And they come in and they kind of talk for maybe an hour, or it could be the person who serves over the leadership or the leadership team coming and doing their own learning objective and having conversation. And it kind of makes me think our first learning objective was how to navigate a predominantly white institute while being a Black male and dealing with microaggressions. And what that looked like. And that was, you know, late September of 2017. And I just remember the excitement and the conversation that followed, not only within that conversation, but after we finished, because, you know, there was a certain energy and folks were excited to talk about it.
I read a while back for the Men in White Coats, I think it's called, Black Men in White Coats. It's the same kind of organization, but it's for doctors. And they go into schools and they talk to young kids in school about becoming a doctor. And that probably has never happened before, specifically in inner cities.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that work is really important. Exposure is expansion is my whole thing. Just like I was exposed to that Summer Bridge program prior to enrolling at Michigan State University, having young Black men and white coats go to, you know, different schools within inner city is important. And also maintaining that connection as well, because it's nice to do one off things, but it's also equally important, or more important, I would argue, to continue.
Would you see that as, I don't want to say franchising, but how would you set it up in another school? So you're basically where you are. When you talk about all the other schools, the Big Ten, how do you, it's not like franchising. I don't mean to put it on that level, but how do you build it out?
Absolutely. So it would just look like talking to administration and seeing how they would want to implement it within their specific institutions, or if there's a need to implement it within their institution. But in order to not step on anybody's toes, for me, I love to do research. So the researcher in me is to go over to, you know, let's say a Minnesota, or let's say at Indiana University, and see if there is a need for a Black male mentorship organization, or if they already have one. Because for me, one of the things that I realized is some institutions already have, you know, that type of space, maybe not similar structure and model, but that same mission of really helping young Black men at their specific institutions. So it could look like collaboration, and it could look like just collaborating with these different mentorship organizations, which I did during my time in leadership, you know, at Michigan State University.
So the approach, based on your background, is research-based, because everyone's talking today about evidence-based. What's the evidence behind it? So collecting the evidence as you build it in, and then possibly looking for success stories, or however you would measure it, by KPIs. Is that kind of what you're looking at?
Absolutely. And after my first year, I think it surprised people my junior year, because we were the MSU Student Organization of the Year. And there's 900 plus organizations. And one of the reasons that we were able to do that was because I had KPIs, and I was able to have deliverables and let people know, hey, this is the cumulative GPA for the young Black men who went through this program. This is the retention rate that we had. It was 100% retention rate, and expanding that over the course of 4 to 5 years. And, you know, now 4 to 6 years, because it's 6 years in, and just looking at that and reflecting on that and kind of showing the numbers and presenting that to boards and different administration, and say that, hey, we're here. And that's actually how I began to, you know, consult for my institution upon completing, and that downtime between finishing undergrad in December 2019. In fact, 4 years ago, 4 years and one day ago today, and beginning my master's program at the University of Pennsylvania in May of 2020.
I see where the number's coming in, 4 years ago in one day. That's cool.
December 14th.
Yeah, that's cool. So if you think about scaling this across organizations, do you, any particular order, do you look at a school that's maybe not represented as well as it should be? Or how do you choose where the next iteration will come from?
Absolutely. It's more so just having conversations with folks, having conversations with administration, using some of my network, and just really tapping into there and seeing what's going on the ground, and seeing if there will be a need for this, a need for just a type of programming such as this. And if there might not be a need, at least at this point for me right now, which is where I'm continuing to expand, it's just going on and sharing my experience and talking to leadership and telling them how I was able to, you know, really develop this type of organization and sustain it at a predominantly white institute such as, you know, MSU.
Yeah. If you had to speak, I'd like to do this with what I call scenario planning. The scenario is you're speaking to college presidents at a conference for college presidents. Mm-hmm. What would be your key theme or message that you would want to leave with them to leave some impact, to get them to start thinking along the lines of your thought process?
Absolutely. Some key thoughts or themes that I would want to leave would particularly be within the areas of governance, culture, and student success. So one of the things is just really listening and hearing the voices of the students, of their students at their institutions, and empowering that, and knowing that students have power and providing them leadership opportunities to exercise that power. As I mentioned, for me, I graduated in December of 2019, so I had a half semester left, but there was administration at Michigan State that empowered me to serve as our unofficial student trustee, and serve and work in a capacity with our administration to just kind of help oversee and look at certain policies that they were implementing that had effects, real life effects, on their students, not just their Black students, but all students at Michigan State, and kind of engage in those type of leadership activities, I would say, and just kind of finding those different things. So that's what that would be the ultimate message that I would encourage governance.
You know, that syncs up with a paper that I read post-COVID, and I think Microsoft did this research. And they said one of the key findings of doing that research and touch points and surveys throughout the COVID experience, year and a half, whatever it was, and the advice that they would give to organizations, it syncs up with exactly what you're talking about. They said, number one, we have to listen more. You have to listen to your employees more. Mm-hmm. And then you have to communicate better.
Right.
So we listen and we act on that and we consistently communicate. Mm-hmm. Which a lot of organizations were not doing. And the primer was that it was always adult to a child. Here are the rules and you abide by the rules. And now, based on what you're saying, now it's adult to adult. And we listen to each other. And we try and figure out a path going forward. Is that summation kind of?
Absolutely. That is very correct. And one of the things that you see, something that kind of influences some of the work and, you know, a new organization that I just, you know, was able to found is just this idea of intergenerational conversation. So when you look at administration or you look at folks who are on these boards at these universities, just looking at the age difference potentially and seeing if it's like, oh, you might be young. So it's like you might not have a lot to say, but you actually might. And it's important to listen to the folks who are going through the day to day, because they more than anybody can really help influence that policy and decision. So when you have these questions, just using the folks who are on campus and just having conversations, maybe focus study groups, and just, you know, setting aside some time to be like, hey, how is your experience here? And really listening to those folks and developing programming around to support those students, because those are in your way, your constituents, those are in the way, like the people who are going to be at your institution for 4 more years.
Well, you know, and from the business side, you know, I call it, those are your new customers. Mm-hmm. And you can't run a so-called business if you don't listen to your customers.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So when you think of And here's something else I read, that as the C-suite gets younger, because the organizations are struggling with the work from home, work from anywhere, new work models and all these things. And a lot of the CEOs are trying to hold on to the old way of doing business. Mm-hmm. But that's shifting, because the key driver to that is the customer is different. And the way that you grew up and built your career one way, that mm-hmm. won't happen again. So the summation of that was that as the C-suite skews younger, mm-hmm. you will see more listening, and you'll see more unique ways of doing business.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think for me, it's kind of reemphasizes this idea of like the job that you have, and they were telling us this in undergrad, the job that you have is not already created. So this idea of being able to adapt and this innovation. And I think for me, as the C-suite it continues to like skew towards younger folks, is just being able to adapt and adapt to different leadership styles. And there's this idea of like some people talk about like, I'm not going to be in a position for 40 plus years and, you know, work and then retire. It's like, no, I want to do this. I want to do that. So kind of for me, coming in more of like the end of millennial, but more so like Gen Z type of energy of like, hey, I want to try all these different things, and I'm going to try all these different things, and I can do it at a high level.
Yeah. I gave a speech the other week, and it was C-suite audience. And one of the key points that I mentioned was the days of the 20 years on the watch over with.
Right.
You know, the graduation, you know, not graduation, but retirement parties and dinners and all those kind of things, because the audience is going to skew younger and younger and younger. And that's just something that you're going to have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on that? Because when you mentioned I mentioned it's getting younger, and mm-hmm. we talk about listening, lots of times that mindset is locked. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of frozen, and it's, how do we unfreeze that? Mm-hmm. You know, we may do a speech and they think about it, but how do we keep them honest to mm-hmm. say we have to rethink?
Absolutely. And your question, keeping folks in leadership, like more seasoned folks, or okay.
Yeah
absolutely. Yeah. So I would say just kind of keeping them, it's just through continuing conversation. Mm-hmm. So for me, what was really important was during my undergraduate studies, I would reach out to a lot of like administration and a lot of folks who had this experience leading different institutions, and I would continually have conversation. And I think through the results, because the numbers don't lie at the end of the day, like, and you show people those results, regardless of how they feel or how they think about your deliverables or how they think about your potential approach within it. If they see your deliverables and it aligns and your deliverables are something that kind of catches people's attention, that's going to make them more susceptible to hearing you out and more susceptible mm-hmm. to really being like, to quote unquote, I guess, taking you serious, because they see the results. But then people can also see the passion. And you talked about the laser focus or being locked in. People can see that. So I just think constant communication. So not just having, like I said, those one-offs, but those extended and expansive yeah. relationships yeah. to really kind of deepen that, so that folks are able to be like, hey, these are some of the roadblocks that I had in my journey. Mm-hmm. And that transparency, I think, is essential, because it humanizes folks, whether, you know, you're 85 years old and you're talking to somebody who's 17, or, you know, you're around the same age. It just humanizes. Yeah. And it kind of brings that level of, hey, you're a human just like me, and you've gone through some stuff too. And hey, these are some roadblocks and things that you should think of. Because for mm-hmm. me, I can't, you know, count the number of times that folks have done that to me, just because I've continued to reach out, and I've come from them in a very humble, transparent place of, hey, these are the places that I'm attempting to go. I would love to learn from you. Yeah. Do you have any advice for me? And I think kind of entering spaces like that, and not necessarily mm-hmm. like, hey, I know it all, I'm doing this and that.
I have the PhD.
Right. I know what I'm talking about. It's like, no, you're always learning. You're always growing. So for me, just being able to, you know, enter these spaces with the will to learn.
Mm. So let's flip that. And you're at a conference with young people, mm-hmm. Students. Mm-hmm. What are some key messages for them? Because, you know, in a lot of cases, you know, they're struggling either from home, either from the university or whatever it is, and a lot of things are going on. What advice would you give them?
The biggest piece of advice I would give them would be similar to advice I would give to folks who were, you know, finished with college, or maybe not have gone to college. It takes a village. So this idea of Ubuntu, I am because we are, okay. And really having that village and having that community, because college can be tough. It can be very difficult. Life goes on. For some folks is the first time out of their house, out of their parents' house. So it's their first time, you know, having some sort of independency, and that transition within itself can be overwhelming. Especially if you're, you know, attending a large institution, but even a smaller institution, it can still be a difficult transition. So finding that community and really leaning into that community, and that being other students, and that being administration, and that being staff and faculty, can really help you find that sense of belonging. Because the more you feel that sense of belonging, the more you have folks who are around you, the more resources you have, even in terms of if you were to have a financial issue, which oftentimes folks do. And, you know, if you're struggling financially, then you'll be able to, hey, I know somebody within this department. I can reach out to them. I can talk to them. And then they can reach out on my behalf and they can come back and let me know, or they'll be able to, you know, tell somebody else, and having folks kind of pour into you. So for me, I'm very much so of the idea of I am because we are. And that would be probably my biggest message, because that's been reflected and my own experience. And all I can do is really share my own testimony or share my own experience and kind of how it got me to where I'm at. And it really starts with the village for me.
You know, a lot of what I'm hearing from you is at your age is to understand how to build relationships, you know, because it is a two-way street and you ask for help when you need help. Right. Again, I'm amazed by the bandwidth at your age and the things that you're talking about and the clarity you're bringing to it. Talk to me a little more about relationships. Where did that come from, you know, in your growth to understand that you could go to people and you said, just say, I'm just trying to understand better. Can you help? Because I think a lot of people struggle with that because, you know, I have the master's degree, I have the MBA, I have this, but meanwhile, on the back end, I'm struggling.
Absolutely. I think for me, the biggest piece of relationships kind of started, or the catalyst for that really was during my undergraduate studies. Coming into undergrad, I'm originally from Detroit, but I moved to where I currently live, Grosse Pointe. So I went from a majority black space to a majority white space, to where there were a lot of black families on the block, to us being the only black family on the block. And that was in fifth grade. And that transition for me was very difficult. So you went from, I had folks who were aunties and uncles to me, to folks who I didn't know. And being in school and being one of many black students to being the only black student, that was I experienced a lot of culture shock. And I didn't have that necessary village at the time. And I know how I responded. Like, thankfully, I had my parents and they really poured into me. And, you know, I was able to do well academically and athletically. But that was a very difficult time in my life. And for me, I was like, there were a few relationships when I had with my track coach, my sophomore year of high school, and maybe like one other, that really kind of made me just want to continue to just go, like continue to want to, you know, just do it. And it was those relationships that I really leaned into. And for me, I was like, you know what? I don't want anybody to feel how I felt. So I think that was really one of the big reasons why, for me, I was like, relationships are so important. And coming from a relatively large family with, you know, four siblings, but then also a lot of cousins and a lot of aunties and uncles.
Yeah. That network.
that network was already embedded within me. And that was huge. Yeah. And for me, I was like, everybody should experience that, whether it be with their own immediate family or people who begin to become family with them, or, you know, chosen friends who become, you know, chosen family. So yeah, just that network and those relationships were just helpful in making life more enjoyable. I feel like there are studies around about the importance of having friendships, about the importance of having relationships to even extend your own life, because isolated experiences can only take you so far.
So how do you stay focused? I mean, PhD you're working on, you've got your nonprofit, you're working on your dissertation, you're still in PhD school. Yeah. Just me reciting that gives me kind of a headache. How do you stay focused?
For me, I stay focused by just keeping the main thing. So for me, I have The Rising Black Man. I just established a nonprofit here within my city, the Grosse Pointe Black Alumni Association, and, you know, and consult for myself as well. But I think there's a synergy amongst all the work that I do. And I also just kind of reflect on just how privileged I am. You know, I know it can be seen as a difficulty navigating a doctoral program or just navigating any type of schooling, especially when you're writing all these papers and stuff. But for me, like, I'm excited because it aligns with the work that I feel called to do. It feels like purpose-oriented work. That doesn't mean that there aren't times where I'm upset and times where I'm like, man, why am I doing this or reevaluating? Because I do have those times. And, you know, it would be dishonest of me to be like, hey, this is all, you know, roses and everything, because it's not. However, I also know that that's going to be in any space. But at the end of the day, I always have the feeling of like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing right now. Mm-hmm. And not just doing it for myself, but being able to take these resources and a lot of these experiences and paying it forward to my community, which I'm able to do, you know, in different capacities, like this alumni association that I have the privilege of, you know, serving as president and CEO of right now.
Wow. One other piece I forgot to add on to those bullet points was, now you're CEO.
Yes.
Of an organization.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot. That's five, I think. I think that's five different journeys that you're on. How did you become the leader? What important leadership lessons that you've learned that kind of it felt comfortable once I was leading, or once I was strategizing and putting all these plans together?
Mm-hmm.
Was there leadership lessons coming through life that said, you know what, I feel pretty comfortable?
Yes.
You know, doing this, it's not a stretch.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think it also came from the experiences and success that I had starting my mentorship organization, Rising Black Men, at Michigan State University, and those experiences. And I think it also came from just other leadership positions that I had in undergrad, in my master's program, and even in my doctoral program last year, being our student department representative. So reaching out or speaking to students who are interested in pursuing the PhD within my department and having conversations with them, or working and building programming for all the students within my department. And also faculty as well, from a social perspective and even from an academic perspective. So I think just having these different experiences for me really kind of affirmed it. And also for me, like I said, a lot of my research is me search in a lot of ways. So as much as I'm doing research, it's doing research on me. And one of the reasons for this work in particular and developing this organization is just because of, like I said, I had very difficult experiences, social experiences growing up here within this district. And I know how tough it was. And for me, my whole work is always, or my whole mission, underlying mission, is to make sure that people don't necessarily feel how I experienced it or how I felt at that time. So now I have the resources, in particular with the social network, to kind of come and build this and bring this together. And we have our first event in 2 days. And I'm very much so looking forward to, you know, working and talking to students. We have over 100 members signed up thus far. And we're just kind of growing within there. So I'm excited about that.
What's the website? Is there a website we could go to take a look at that?
So our website launches December 23rd, but right now we do have a Facebook and an Instagram. And we just yesterday had a news article within our local newspaper that I can also share with folks who are interested in learning more about the organization and some of the programming that we're currently doing and plan to continue to expand upon.
Wow, yeah. Share that with us, because we'll do a rebroadcast of this show on Wednesday.
Okay.
So if you could share that, we could scroll it on the screen. As you're moving into the next phase of your life, and I mean that in a good way, because as young as you are, the PhD angle to the social entrepreneur, do you see a choice? Mm-hmm. Are you going to take them both to a certain point and maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. It's something I continue to just think about on my day to day of what do I do with this PhD? What places do I see myself occupying with this, especially with it coming up in 2025? For me, at this point, I see myself potentially going and and doing being a tenure track professor. So like engaging in that work because I have such a passion for teaching. I have such a passion for working with young minds and the next leaders within our society. And also I see myself continue to expand from a consulting aspect of continuing to work with different nonprofits and continue to go out and like do program development and do program evaluations and engage in that work as well, because I see myself eventually at some point like having something community wise here to where there's like a building similar to like a Mark Lamont's Kill, like Uncle Bobby's, where it's like a coffee shop. Folks could come in and we have like, you know, there might be some books that people can purchase and just kind of a meeting space, a communal space, because like I said, a lot of my work is community oriented work. So having those spaces where folks can come in and be able to, you know, just kind of talk with each other, support each other, and be there for each other. So I see myself kind of occupying, again, this is the Gen Z, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that. That's very much so my energy, and that's something that I plan to do.
Yeah. I know it's hard to stay focused. I want to do a quick shout out to some of our listeners. You know, John Self is based in Texas, and he's talking about how cold it is there. Frequent listener, always here every Friday morning, as well as Joe Levy. Joe and I worked together at IBM years ago. Great to see you reaching the younger generation of future leaders. Thanks, Joe, for bringing that up, and doing that. But we have a large audience, with the series. And one of the key points that we look for is to bring people like yourselves in to talk about how do you get to where you are? Because sometimes when you look at people that are successful, and you look at the top of the pyramid, and this is why I always like to start with walk us through the journey, because it was not easy. Absolutely. And I know it was not easy.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the thing of just like that transparency of it. It's for me, success is relative. And also for me, it takes a village. Like I didn't get here alone, and it wasn't just, hey, because of the merit of my own work and working hard. Sure, that played a part in it. But there was so much more. And for me, it's just being able to acknowledge that and talk about, you know, some of the struggles that I had and talk about being in a library late at night and not knowing what I was going to do in undergrad of like, hey, how am I going to figure out what's next for this organization? And talking about just, you know, having conversations with folks and just kind of figuring out what I want to do next steps or, you know, kind of things not going my way, but being able to take a step back and adapt and adjust to certain challenges. But like I said, I was willing because of some of the experiences that I had, you know, growing up in the school district. So by the time I got to college, it was like, I've already gone through a lot of challenging experiences and whatnot. Yeah. So I'm just kind of ready to take off at this point. And even then taking off, still acknowledging, you know, the challenges that come with that.
Mm-hmm. So, when you think about the challenges that you talked about, undergrad, in grad, and then going there, you just kind of morphed all of those learnings into the next step.
Absolutely.
You know, you looked at what you've gone through, the struggles you've had along the way, having a network, and then basically what you did was just package that.
Yes, because some people, I think for me, I look at things as wins and learning experiences. I don't necessarily look at things as wins and losses. So even if it is a quote unquote loss, I'm learning from it, and I'm learning what not to do moving forward, or I'm learning what to do moving forward. So for me, it kind of goes back to what I believe is just this growth mindset. Some people like to call it a winner's mentality. I call it more so a growth mindset of I want to learn. I want to be the best Tim that I can be so that I can not only show up 100% in the best for me, but I can show up 100% in the best for other people, and in particular the people who I'm in day-to-day interactions with, because they deserve that and I deserve that as well.
Yeah, I love that. That's my term too, growth mindset. Mm-hmm. You know, learning every day. I was telling someone the other day, I said, every day I go out, I'm like a sponge. I want to learn from everything. I want to learn from the taxi driver.
Yeah.
The stories he's telling me. And it's always open. And what you find is after you begin doing that, when you walk out of your door, you're ready to learn from any and everyone. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I found, I learn more from talking to regular people than I do with the people I normally deal with, the so-called big shots, the so-called C-suite side. Because from their side, you know, it's a totally different learning experience, but it's much more grounded.
Absolutely. And I think for me, some of the most simple things, quote unquote, simple things are the most profound. Yes. Even in a biblical reference, because I'm very big in my faith. So my dad's a pastor amongst other things. So growing up, a preacher's kid, you know, there were certain sermons and, you know, certain things within the Bible and paradoxes that I would listen to. And I would be like, hey, like, you know, like, wow, this means a lot. So even those conversations, like you said, with somebody who might be a taxi or Uber driver, and you know, it might be some simple things said, but it's most profound. And I remember my first time in New York. The person who was driving me over to the hotel, we were sitting and I was telling him about some of the work that I was doing. And this was in 2018. So I was like 22, maybe 21. And I was like, hey, I'm thinking about this. I'm doing this and that. And he was like, man, you got ambition. You're going to make it. And that was all I needed to hear. It was just something that was very simple. But I remember that from that time. He was like, you're going to make it anywhere you go. But it was just that encouragement. And it wasn't a lot of fancy words. It wasn't a lot of this and that. But it was just that visceral, raw, like that connection, that human connection of like, hey man, you're gonna make it. I believe in you. Look at me in my eyes and everything, and I believe like you're gonna make it. You're gonna be good. And I always remember that. So it's those interactions for me that just kind of affirm me and keep me going, as much as, you know, an evaluation that I might get at the university level of, hey, you do X, Y, and Z well. So I think for me, it's just important to continue to just, you know, I think, you know, just keep that in mind as I navigate.
I understand. Well, Tim, thank you so much, man. You know, one of the goals of the show is, like I said, to bring people in who appear at the top of the pyramid to talk it through. John Self said he's going to connect with you offline. John is an executive search consultant, so he deals in the healthcare business, but he would be great for you to connect with. And he said he's going to reach out to you. But as I said, the show is about people talking about the struggles they've gone through. How do they come to, you know, the learnings and all those kinds of things. And today you brought it out. So I really want to thank you for being a guest.
My pleasure.
And any closing thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I would just say, regardless of where you are, age-wise, it's never too late to start. It's never too late to start. It's never too early to begin. So I would just say, just go out and live in your truth, walk in your truth, and do things that bring you joy. For me, I do a lot of dancing on my social media. My thing is hashtag dancing to the PhD. So you can find me dancing all the time. You can find me running all the time, because these are different self-care mechanisms that I've implemented within my own life that continues to bring me joy, that allows me to show up for myself. And like I said, show up for other people. So just continue to just remember that. Remember that everybody, regardless of where you're at, regardless of what position or title that you hold, you have the power to impact at least one person. And just that one impact is important. So you got me excited over here, you know. But those are just some of the, you know, kind of tidbits and you know, things that I have as we get towards the conclusion.
Okay, man. Thank you so much. Hang on for a minute as we close out. Thank you.
Take the CEO series with you anywhere, anytime. All episodes are now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and major streaming platforms. It's not just an interview. It's a masterclass in leadership.